C7. Number 14A.
Finished yesterday the chapter 8, and therefore finished the second vertical, the Christ chapters. Actually, we should now see what is the common denominator in the Christ chapters. And in order to sense somehow what it must be, let's just refresh what is in these second four chapters. We have seen in animal magnetism, we get the sense that there is only one power of manifestation, that we don't have to deal with two different powers of manifestation, so that there is only one God good that expresses himself. Then when it came to science, theology, and medicine, we could see that this manifestation and God is one, that there is only God and manifestation, but that these are one, Immanuel, God with us. And so we feel that the relationship of God to man is under consideration. First, in the fifth chapter, that God alone manifests anything. Then that manifestation in the sixth chapter is one with its origin, that the manifestation is not separate from God. And as we go on to the seventh chapter, we begin to see that this manifestation, God with us, is omnipotent both in the realm of truth and in the realm of error, though that there is no duality of a power sense, that we have not the power sense in the divine and the power sense in the realm of error, but that there is only one Immanuel, that one Immanuel is Immanuel in every field, is powerful, omnipotent in every field. I like to call it field or realm because it indicates the focal point of Christianity. Can you see, the moment you have the realm, the field, the universe, you touch the focal point of Christianity. So that we still feel it has to do with God's oneness with man, God's oneness with man being still one, no matter if we consider this oneness in the field of truth or in the field of error, still there, God is one, and its manifestation. And then when we come to the eighth chapter, we ask ourselves, but where does that field, that realm exist, the realm of truth and the realm of error, where does that exist? And it doesn't exist somewhere in time or space, it exists always in consciousness. And so the eighth chapter, Footsteps of Truth, shows us the oneness of God and man as consciousness, that God and man have the same consciousness, that therefore there is only one consciousness, the divine consciousness, the Christ consciousness, and that Christ consciousness is always the same consciousness, no matter if I consider it in the realm of spirit, or if I consider it in the human realm. It's still consciousness. We cannot somehow push out the divine consciousness out of the human realm and say, you get out, there is now another consciousness present. This consciousness is ever present. This Immanuel is ever present. So divine consciousness is ever present, and therefore can be the ever-present divine consciousness even in the human. Perhaps I haven't pointed out yesterday what just comes back into my mind as I was saying, that in this 8th chapter is shown that the realm in which this Immanuel goes on is the realm of consciousness, where the divine consciousness is the same consciousness as what happens in the human, at God and man being one. She brings out in the 8th chapter, as in no other chapter, really the sense of a divine ego. Now we know what the divine ego means, the divine I means. It's a lot about this in this chapter. It means consciousness. The ego, capitalized, is the consciousness, the awareness of God. That's the ego. The moment God is described as the I am, or the I, or the ego, it means the conscious I. And here we see that the man has no other ego but the divine ego, that man is the reflection of the divine ego, doesn't have a special personal ego of its own, indicating again there is only one consciousness, one subjective consciousness, and that subjective consciousness is a subjective consciousness which I can use in the divine as well as in the human. So if we try to see what is the common denominator, we can see it's always the relationship between God and man as oneness. That relationship is a one-to-one relationship, and so perhaps we could put on the top of the vertical here, under the term Christ, perhaps we could put there God's oneness with men. God's oneness with men. Yes? Now, we can see the difference already between the Word chapters and the Christ chapters when we consider those epitomes in the index I. In the Word we have man's oneness with God. That's usually the divine approach, that we see that we are one with God. And then the Christ is always the standpoint of God, what God has in view, and therefore it's God's oneness with men. We can see that these are two very different subjects, that they describe two very different aspects of the oneness of being. Now, we go further to the Christianity chapters, to the chapter on creation. And we know from the textbook matrix, at the moment we touch Christianity and those three chapters, that actually the focal point of interest changes. In the Christ chapter we had the focal point, how does God manifest itself as itself? That was the Christ. When God manifests itself, there is then an outcome of that manifestation called a creation, called a universe, called a realm, called a field of activities, a field of ideas, whatever we call it. It's shifting its focal point to the point of idea. In the Word, you know, we have the focal point is principle. In the Christ, the focal point is the way principle manifests itself. Then when principle manifests itself as ideas, the focal point of Christianity is the realm of ideas, and therefore we consider here mostly the ideas. Naturally, at the point of oneness, we will have to see the oneness of the universe of ideas, But we also know that ideas are never separate from its principle, therefore they will always somehow be considered in its relationship to its origin, to its principle. The chapter creation gives us right away an indication that the whole standpoint has changed to the focal point of idea. Creation here means the created universe. Creation does not mean here the act of creating. That would not be the focal point of Christianity. The action of creating would be an action of God, therefore of the Word, and bringing out its creation would be a activity of the Christ. But once we contemplate what has been created, the creation, the created creation, so to say, is showing us, therefore, the focal point of idea as a universe of idea. In this chapter, we have the very first sentence, eternal truth is changing the universe. That's from the standpoint of the textbook matrix. When we consider really the line of unfoldment, what happens, here we would see that going out from the footsteps of truth, as before, that if we have a consciousness of that truth, the truth consciousness, that consciousness is going to change our experience, our universe. So we know that now, starting out with truth, that this is giving us a completely different sense of the universe. What kind of universe? Or we could ask ourselves, what kind of a universe had to be changed? If the universe had to be changed, had it to be changed from what into what? And here we see that there is a dualistic sense in the human mind about the universe, that from a material standpoint we feel that the universe is a limited universe, limited in time and space, and that eternal truth is changing that concept of the universe into a concept of a universe that is infinite, that is ideational. Therefore, the question could arise, are there two universes? Is there a universe that is material, limited? And is there next to that, or superimposed on that, or anywhere else, a universe that is spiritual, infinite, ideational? Are there two universes? Now, eternal truth changes the universe, meaning apparently there is only one universe, but that universe can be changed. That there is one universe, but that looked at from the standpoint of not truth, we have a limited universe. Looked at from the standpoint of truth, we have an unlimited universe. Therefore, she brings up the whole question right at the beginning of that chapter, that there are two views of the universe, a mystical view of creation, namely a creation by mortal mind. That's one kind of universe, a universe that is actually an induction from the material universe, from a material belief. And so on the other side, we have the other universe that is going to present, namely accurate view of creation by the divine mind. That's on the introductory paragraph. It's usually quite interesting to see that in most cases, Mrs. Eddy would put forward in the first paragraph or in the first few paragraphs really the proposition of a chapter. Here she puts forward the proposition of the chapter, do we have to deal with a universe that is created by ancient concepts and opinions, by the mystical human theories of creation, or do we have to deal with a universe that is created by the divine mind? And right away we have actually therefore the proposition, do we have to deal with one universe? Do we have to deal with two different kind of universes? The answer that we naturally get here is, from the point of view of oneness, that there is only one universe. What kind of universe? He would show that it is just that kind of universe, which is a universe of ideas, an ideational universe. An ideational universe. But naturally, now comes the point, naturally an idea is never an idea by itself. It's always an idea of the Infinite One. Because she has shown now through the first 8 chapters that we cannot separate principle from its idea, that we cannot separate man and God, nor God and man. Therefore, if we talk about an ideational universe, we don't talk just about ideas, we always talk about ideas of God, ideas that are embedded in God, that are brought back to its principle. The point now is, are there then actually two kinds of universes, or are there only two views on the one and only universe? This is the question. Whereas human belief thinks there are two universes and are quite aware that there is a material universe with all the material things, that is a universe that evolves in the framework of time and space. Whereas next to that, or superimposed on that, or embedded in it somewhere, is a spiritual universe, an infinite universe, a universe that has no limits. And so we make somehow a funny duality that the limited and the unlimited somehow work together. That through the limited universe sounds through an unlimited universe, and also that the unlimited universe can bring forth a limited universe. This is a terrific big question that has always been of great interest to the thinkers, that has become again of a tremendous interest to the new biologists, that they really want to find out, is life spiritual or is life just another form of matter? And we know that in biology we have today this two great schools of biology, and practically both schools have their Nobel Prize winners, though they differ completely. The one that say, well, the universe with life can all be explained materially, and the others say, no, we can only explain to a certain extent the material universe, but we cannot explain on the basis of material theories, the universe of life. So this is a very modern and new issue again of today, and therefore for us of very great interest. So if we take the oneness and see there is only one universe, then naturally we can see, yes, but this one universe looked at from a standpoint outside the oneness will be a finite view and therefore a finite universe. In other words, it is the view and not the universe that is finite. The moment we use finite means of looking at the universe, say the moment we use the 5 physical senses to look at the universe, we will always find a limited universe. if we use an unlimited method of looking at the universe, we'll always find an unlimited universe. So it is not the universe itself that is either finite or infinite. It's again the way we look at it. It's again standpoint. Do we take a standpoint from God, or do we take a standpoint outside of God? And according to that standpoint, the one only existing universe appears then as either limited or as unlimited. But this does not make two universes. It's still one. What we do is that we determine to take two different standpoints. And this must be seen. Therefore, in this chapter, it is where Mrs. Eddy would, in various ways, always show that actually that which seems to be a wrong universe, a limited universe, is actually a true universe. You know, she says, for instance, when examined in the light of divine science, you see, when examined, when we view it, when we analyze it in the light of divine science, when we take the measures, when we take the means of divine science and then examine with the means of divine science, can you hear? It's the approach. When examined in the light of divine science, mortals, that would be the wrong universe, mortals present more than is detected upon the surface. Since inverted thoughts must be counterfeits of truth. You see what she says? It says, here is a mortal. Okay, here is a mortal. But if I throw the light of divine science on that mortal and look with the eyes of divine science, that mortal presents not a mortal. That mortal presents more than is detected on the surface, since it is just an inverted picture, an inverted image, a counterfeit of truth. So that actually, if I can look at the mortal or at the mortal universe with the eyes of divine science, I don't see a mortal universe, I see the universe of truth. You know, it's really here where one begins to understand what then in recapitulation, I shouldn't go into another chapter, but just take out the reference there, where you begin to see what Jesus, what Mrs. Eddy meant when she said that Jesus saw in science the perfect man, where to the mortal sense a mortal appears. So exactly there, where a mortal appears, Jesus saw in science. He looked in science, and he saw the perfect man, not the mortal. That's what Mrs. Eddy wants to bring out here too. That it is always only standpoint, not the thing itself, that makes a thing what to appear as what it is. It isn't the material universe which is something per se and says, I'm a material universe and I'm always a material universe, I'm always a limited universe, that you can't change, that's my entity and my identity. Christian Science comes and says, no, that's not true. It's not what appears that is an identity, it's the way we look at it that makes it. The way we look at it, we change the phenomena. If I look with the eyes of divine science or science, I can't help but see an unlimited universe. The standpoint of observation, the way of observing, changes the phenomena. And you know that this is what the physicists have found out, that the physicists, in the year 1925, they found out suddenly that this is not true, what science, natural science has stated all through the centuries, namely that a thing, an object, is an object, and that an object is absolutely independent on the subject, on the observer. The observer is the subject. That is absolutely uninfluenced by subjective views. That was a fundamental statement in any science, and therefore every scientific research work had to be done objectively, meaning that one couldn't put any subjective view into the object. But then, when they were investigating the subatomic realm, they began to see that the way they were observing this microscopic realm, the realm of the subatomic realm, that the way they observed it, they changed the phenomena. So that actually they could never anymore make a distinction between the subjective and the objective, that the way they began to observe the little quantums, they would change the quantums. They would change the universe. From that time on, they had to change the whole philosophy of science and the whole concept of science and see that subject and object are one and that we cannot make a distinction between subject and object. Actually, that opened up a completely different view on science. See, it's like this. They have a very nice illustration. They say, you know, when we investigate the subatomic realm, it is actually like a blind man who wants to find out the form of a snowflake. Well, because he can't see it, he uses another way, namely he touches the snowflake. But the moment he touches it, naturally the form of the snowflake changes. It melts, and it just always feels a drop of water. So that the way of observing changes the object. Naturally, we don't know enough of this subatomic physics, electrophysics, the physics of the subatomic realm. But still, the philosophical consequences can be understood, and they are presented to the layman today, and they are actually what Mrs. Eddy shows here fundamentally. That the standpoint of observation determines what kind of a universe we have. Just as you remember that nice symbol that Le Continu gave, that when he said, well, if you look with a blunt eye to the edge of a razor blade, you see a straight line, but if you look at it through the medium of the subatomic field, then you only see, instead of a straight line, you see something like a swarm of gnats, namely all the electrons swirling around in an empty space. So the universe changes when the point of view of observation and the mean of observation changes. In other words, the subjective point determines the objective universe. This is the great change that has come in, even in the field of natural science.